Welcome to the 10th anniversary celebration of the Center for Philosophy of Natural and Social Science. To mark the occasion, we are talking this week about futures. On Monday evening, Malcolm Longaire, the head of the Cavendish Laboratory in Cambridge, talked to us about the future of physics. And then on Tuesday, John Maynard Smith, who is, by the way, a fellow of our center, told us about the future of biology. And this evening, we've got our own Tony Giddens to tell us about the future of the social sciences. Now, we're really grateful to Tony for coming along and, I know that he thinks about the subject all the time, but it's not the kind of subject one has a lecture on in one's pocket. So we're really grateful to you, Tony, for already had it in your pocket. One of the remarkable things about Tony's time at the LSE, besides his coming to learn to love philosophy since he's been here, has been his constant and, hard effort to develop innovative projects in all areas, and with some success, witness the new program for the analysis of risk and regulation. And I think that's one of the things that the school is very grateful to him for, and we too, and hope that this effort will be successful. The CPNSS is in conjunction with our anniversary launching an appeal to develop a new program in philosophy and social policy to expand our program on Darwin at LSE and in general to inspire others like Tony to learn to love philosophy at the LSE. Tony, would you tell us about the future of the social sciences, please?
Let me say first of all what a pleasure and honor it is to be asked to give this lecture, and let me also add my congratulations to those that I'm sure other lecturers have given for the 10th anniversary of the center. The center does have a crucial role to play in the LSE, and I look forward to it being around for a very long time as an expanding part of the institution. I'd also like to pay tribute to Nancy as the director of the center, and actually I think as one of the first people that I met when I got to the LSE, when we went out to a Thai restaurant just up the Beihoven tube station there, and you gave me a copy of your book on Neurath, which I read with interest. So congratulations anyway to the center. The topic of my talk tonight is the future of the social sciences, but I think if you are a social scientist, as Richard Sennett was hinting to me on the way into the lecture, you might begin by turning this phrase around and ask what social scientists have to say about the future, because they do say, or try to say, an awful lot, actually, about it. If you look at the work of historical sociologists of somewhat dubious repute, I have to say, some of them have claimed that the future is actually a modern invention, that in medieval times and before, people did not have the kind of conception of the future which we tend to have now. And specifically, it's been argued that the way in which people in Western societies tend to envisage the future owes quite a lot to some of the Enlightenment philosophers who saw the future as a sort of territory, a territory which we can colonize, a territory which we can conquer, a territory in which through the advance of science and the advance of human knowledge we can confidently occupy. Well, if they did think that, I think we can confidently say the future has not turned out that way. The future today is the province of a whole area of academic specialization by people who call themselves futurologists. I am a member, as maybe Richard is, I don't know, of the World Futures Society. And the World Futures Society regularly sends me a raft of books and articles about technological development and so forth. But if you look at the history of futurology, I have to say it doesn't encourage you too much. If you look back to the 1960s, Herman Kahn wrote a whole series of predictions about what the world in 2000 would look like. And although some of these predictions were not so far off the mark, plenty of them do sound odd when you actually stand here, incredibly, in the year 2000. For example, he predicted that nuclear devices would be used for mining. He predicted that the world would be lit artificially by artificial moons out in space, which would reflect light down onto the Earth. And he predicted that by the year 2000, the human lifespan would be 150 years, which people are now predicting again for the 21st century. So all this should be salutary for anyone who seeks to speak about the future of anything. But I would point out interesting little quirky puzzle about all this. Although we know the future is so hard to grasp, we probably do discuss the future today more than any other generation or any other society in the past. And you have to ask the question whether or not the endless discussion of the future actively prevents us knowing it. In any case, I would say that anyone who asks about the future of anything, whether it's an academic subject or any other area of life, should observe three maxims or three principles. First of all, that history will continue to take us by surprise. In spite of our efforts to study historical trends and to project them into the future. It's easy to see examples of this. The most recent, I would say, most impressive in some ways, was the transformations in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. There you had a whole barrage of people whose lives were devoted to studying the Soviet Union, to the intricacies of Kremlinology, the East European societies more generally. I don't know of anybody who actually predicted that the events in Eastern Europe would unfold in the way in which they did, quickly, without violence, Soviet communism, as it were, disappearing almost overnight. Quite extraordinary phenomenon, which only in the most general way, really, did those who are antagonistic to the Soviet Union sort of generically project, but no one, I think, thought would happen in the way in which it did. I remember walking with Ernest Gellner through Prague in about 1992 or so, and he had been in Prague before the communists came, but he told me he never expected to be walking through Prague after the communists had gone again. I mean, he was himself one, a great expert on the Soviet Union, but he told me he had thought that the Soviet Union would last 100 years, and we all remember how kind of solid, totalitarian, if you like, Soviet Union looked. Second principle, history is not linear. Well, Hegel knew that, although you could say Marx forgot it. There's a very interesting book on the history of, well, several books actually, on technology by the medieval historian Jean Gampel. He wrote a book on medieval technology in which he tried to show something counterintuitive or against the conventional wisdom, which was that the Middle Ages were a period of technological innovation, not a period of stagnation. But more relevant for what I'm talking about here, he wrote this interesting little book on contemporary technology, which interestingly enough is actually called The End of the Future. And in this book he traces out the history of technologies to show that what people thought would happen with these technologies is far from what actually did happen. In the 1960s, the time when Herman Kahn was writing, it seemed to many people that Los Angeles was the city of the future, and a car-based civilization was, as it were, not only here to stay, what would be the logic of transportation systems, but Gampol says, well, what's happened? You have a movement backwards, which he says, back to the train, back to the tram, back to the bicycle, back to walking. And he traces other developments like the emergence of construction of nylon. Those of us who are old enough will very well remember nylon, which was supposed to be the high-tech fabric of the future. As but he says, instead of nylon, back to cotton, back to wool. That's been the recent history of clothing. If you look at jet travel, he says we're still traveling the world in the same wide-body jets that were invented 30 years ago, and there is no successor to Concorde, which looked like a technological marvel for the future, but turned out, as it were, to be the end of the line. So these reflections, I think, are interesting. They're more complicated than he asserts, however, I think. They alert you to the principle that history tends to move dialectically. If I was a business person, I wouldn't be looking at what contemporary technology is doing, as it were. I'd be looking at the opposite. I'd be looking at the kinds of reactions that people might make to it if I wanted to find a product niche which might make me rich in the future. But things are more complicated than Gampol says, because if you look at the jet plane example, although jet planes haven't advanced, modern travel and all it's done to the world, including ecological damage it does to the world, is inseparable from computers. Computers and computerization have completely revolutionized the cost base of jet travel. Without computerization, you wouldn't have all these easy jets and all these cheap flights all over the world that all of us many of us spend a good deal of our lives actually on. Anyhow, the future is not linear. One shouldn't just think of the future, at least not always, as simply a linear extension of the present. Unfortunately, the people who built the dome seem not to know this principle. Thirdly, our predictions of the future actively influence the future, and this is more and more the case the more we live in a world of, as it were, saturated information. In sociology, we have traditional terms for designating the reflexive nature of predictions. Robert Merton famously spoke of the self-fulfilling prophecy. The self-fulfilling prophecy is when you announce something and the announcing of that something causes it to become true. So if you do a survey of sexual behavior on the campus and you find that 70% of people on the campus are doing something unspecifiable, people read about it and think, oh well, they're all doing it, I might as well join in as well. And even if it were not true originally, the very prediction might make it come true. The opposite, obviously, is the self-negating prophecy, which has, like the self-fulfilling one, various potential social uses, so that if you stick to the example of sexual behavior and you consider the phenomenon of AIDS, governments all around the world actively tried to disseminate information about AIDS, not just in order to tell people about it, but in order that the predictions that they made about the future would not come true. In fact, those predictions, at least in Western countries, have not come true. And again, interesting consequences, what I won't discuss here, flow from this, but kind of reflexive nature of prediction is deeply entangled in the debate about how far you should scare people about various, going back to risk, noxious possible consequences of the changes that we see around us in order to prevent the trends which are diagnosed actually emerging as true. And all the way from global warming and whatnot, you see this as a characteristic part of the kind of society in which we live. These reflections don't show that one shouldn't try and anticipate the future. They don't show that there aren't trends that one can diagnose which will give us some sense of what the future may hold, but they surely are salutary in terms of anyone who simply goes forth and says this is what the future social world will look like. So when one's looking at the future of the social sciences, I think it's more effective than trying to say this, this, and this will happen, is to look at current trends of development, look at problem areas that surround them, and see how they're likely to structure the debates which will dominate the social sciences for the next few years. The social sciences have always prospered during periods of substantial change. And in my view anyway, we are living through such a period at the moment. I think that the changes going on in the world, with all the qualifications that I just made about analysing out what might be happening in the world, is a bit like what happened in the late 18th century. What happened in the late 18th century with the advent of modern industrial production was that you got a kind of shakeout of basic social institutions. You've got a shakeout, the nature of the family changed, the nature of urban life changed, the nature of sovereignty and nation states changed, of course the economy changed, and wider transnational institutions changed as well. It's at least plausible to suppose that because of some of the transformations I'm just going on to talk about, that something similar is happening in the world today. That we are living through a period of institutional shakeout, which is hard for us to grasp and relate to individually and emotionally in our everyday lives, but which is should be the terrain for the social sciences. The social sciences can't allow us to grasp some of the fundamental transformations which are affecting our lives, then I think you would have to conclude that they don't amount to very much. So I'd like to argue here that the future of the social sciences, and I mean by future, not really long-term future, but maybe the next 4 or 5 years or so, is as much as one can safely speculate about, are likely to be dominated by what I call the four great debates, four great problem areas, which are emerging as fundamental to what the social sciences in the early part of the 21st century are all about. The first of these come as no surprise to anyone who's followed some of the things that I've struggled to write while being director of the LSE, but produced a few things I term the great globalization debate. The great globalization debate. The history of the term globalization is amazing, and its entry into popular consciousness is amazing. Only about 10, 15 years ago, hardly anyone used the term globalization. Very difficult to remember that. Wasn't used much in the academic literature, and it certainly wasn't used in the popular press. Now, of course, the term globalization is everywhere, and you can't open a newspaper, I think almost literally, without seeing some reference to globalization, either on the economics pages or in some other parts of the newspaper. Now, since globalization has come from nowhere and has come to be everywhere, it's not surprising that it is the center of fierce debate, and I believe this debate will be very significant for the next few years. Now, the early part of this debate was really a debate between people who were skeptical about the whole idea that globalization means anything, that the world really is changing, that the world really is becoming more interdependent, and those who stood on the other side, as it were, and were something like fierce advocates of not just the idea of globalization, but the idea that globalization has already changed a large amount of the structures of the world. The first group tended to, on the whole, be on the political left, and on the whole wanted to say, well, the changes going on in the world, if they do exist, are no greater than those that happened 100 years ago, when you had the first emergence of a global economy, and you had a good deal of trade across the world, you had trade in currencies and so forth. So these writers argued that there's not much that's different today from that period. So to suppose that we are in some sense living in a new global age, as I in fact think to be the case, these writers argued, is a false assumption. On the other hand, were those writers who argued that changes that have already happened are so fundamental that they've already destroyed many of our basic institutions. These are people who write about the end of the nation state. So far, I've counted three books about the end of the nation state, with the title, The End of the Nation State, and no doubt there will be more. These writers claim that we live in a borderless economy. Already, not only have nations become obsolete, but political power has become largely obsolete too, because most things in the world are simply settled by financial markets and the global economy. Well, this was the early globalization debate, but I feel that debate is now largely over. Of course, there are still people around who hold to this one or other of these two views. But I don't think those who studied the issue in any detail do any longer. There is, I think, much more general acceptance now that globalization is a reality, albeit a very complex reality, that it is affecting fundamental changes in the world, that it is different from the late 19th century, although it does bear, in some respects, close affinities with that period. And that there is something new in some which has entered our lives over the last 20 or 30 years. Most scholars do now agree on this. The great globalization debate is therefore no longer really about whether globalization is a reality. It is a debate about the consequences of globalization. And that debate, as anyone who owns a newspaper can see, is all around us. It was there in Seattle, it was there in the streets of London 3 or 4 weeks ago, it was there outside of the White House during the IMF meetings in Washington. The new debate is about whether or not the extraordinary changes happening in financial markets, the advent of a global electronic-based money economy, founded around 24-hour money markets, whether the advent of new forms of communication like the internet, whether the forms of social change associated with this, such as the declining sovereignty of states insofar as it exists, whether these things are producing a world which is so insecure, is so fractured, is so divided between rich and poor, that we should be seeking to reverse the changes that have happened. Well, since I'm primarily commenting on the future of the social sciences, I only briefly say what my views are on this great globalization debate, because it is set to continue. But I believe that globalization is a complex phenomenon. It is not just the globalization of economic markets. It is not just financial markets. It is, like I described it earlier, a kind of institutional transformation of our lives. And I think, therefore, globalization is driven primarily by new systems of communication rather than simply by systems of economic exchange. And I think it's changing many things, including reshaping nations, not destroying the nation state, because you could say this is the high point of the nation state. This is the first time that there haven't been any empires in the world. You could say the Soviet Union was the last imperial system, really, in world history. And this period is a period of the universal application of the nation state. But plainly, national sovereignty is altered under contemporary conditions of globalization. The protesters in the streets are against globalization, and some people on the other side are for globalization, but I don't think in the great globalization debate these positions make any sense. Globalization is really a sort of portmanteau term for a cluster of changes transforming the world, including the disappearance of the Cold War, among other changes. So it doesn't make sense to say that you can be for or against it. And plainly, so the globalization of communications, for example, is directly involved in the protest movements. I don't know if anyone here heard Chris Patton's first Reith lecture, which I went to when he originally gave it, in which he gave this very fun example of someone holding up a placard in Seattle saying, "Join the worldwide movement against globalization." A lot of the people who gathered in Seattle did so because they were able to communicate by new communications technologies. So you have a complex story involved in all this. If you do look just at the sort of brutish aspects of economic globalization, you can still make a pretty good case for free trade, actually, I think. Most detailed comparisons recently made show that if you look at the poorest economies in the world and you compare open poor economies with closed poor economies, the open poor economies have growth rates of about 4%. And the closed poor economies have growth rates of 0%. Of course, an enormous amount is hidden in all that, but by and large, I feel that the result of the great globalization debate will be a reshaping of how we think about the world, but it will also involve, by and large, a positive attitude for economic and social development of some of the changes that are happening. The second great debate is what I would call the great debate about technology. The great, to some extent, about science and technology, recognizing the differences which people rightly insist on between science and technology. When you talk about the great debate about technology, as a sociologist or economist, of course, you tend to think information technology, first of all. And broadly speaking, this would be correct, I think. The role of information technology in reshaping modern production systems and more broadly the kind of society in which we live has already been very, very profound. You just look, for example, at the history of manufacture in Western economies. A generation ago in this country, nearly 40%, or according to some estimates, over 40% of the labor force were in blue-collar manufacturing jobs. Now, only about 17% of the labor force is in this kind of job, and that proportion is still dropping. The average for the EU countries is about the same, about 17%, and it's more or less the same in the United States. Now, bearing in mind what I said earlier about history surprising us about reversals of history and so forth, I think on the whole we would expect these trends to continue because we know what their dynamics are. The 17% who work in manufacture today produce more goods than the 40% who worked in manufacture a generation ago. Some people say, and this is, you know, in the dubious realms of historical prediction, but I think it may turn out possibly to be accurate, that manufacture will look increasingly like agriculture. Agriculture, at one point you had well over 30% of the population, Western countries, working in agriculture. Now you have less than 2% of the population working in agriculture, and they're producing more than the 30% did 70 or 80 years ago. Some people are seriously suggesting that maybe only 5% of the population will be working in manufacture some 15 or so years from now. We do not, of course, know for the reasons I gave earlier, but I think it is actually, given the direction of technological change, a feasible projection. Now, if you look at, of course, the decline in manufacture obviously is not just due to information technology, but it is a very significant influence on it. And if you look at the social changes that's produced, they are quite extraordinary, because when you had a large blue-collar manufacturing sector, or large manufacturing sector, you had a large working class to go along with it. And the division between the working class and the rest, as it were, was the basic division of Western politics. By and large, Labour parties, socialist parties, stood for the working class, and the working class, by Marxists, was regarded as the agency of future historical transformation. Well, now there is the working class, in an orthodox sense, is only a marginal part of contemporary societies. You could say that many other people exist in contemporary conditions of insecurity and so forth that make them a bit similar class positions, but in truth, this is almost a complete reversal of the projections that Marx himself had about the future 100 or so years ago. And again, not many people predicted it before it happened. I don't know anyone really predicted it before it happened, but it is likely to be an ongoing trend. Information technology now extends into the impact of the internet, and of course most countries you see like internet mania at the moment. I mean, I've been traveling in a few EU countries, and the EU has not only caught up the US in terms of its enthusiasm for the internet, but surpassed it. There is a true mania in a lot of EU countries about the impact of the internet. The internet, I think, should be seen simply as an extension of the already extensive role of information technology in transforming our lives. But having been myself something of a skeptic about it, I do think its impact is likely to be profound. And it's likely to be most profound in sectors of orthodox business rather than in the forms of e-business that tend to get most prominence at the moment. As you'll probably know, about 80% of e-business startups are business-to-business rather than business-to-consumer. And they are already radically transforming what a lot of the big companies do. For instance, Ford, Daimler, Chrysler, and GM have got together to form an enormous global parts exchange system operating wholly through internet technology, which already has a turnover of millions, and it's only just started. And again, with all the reservations about trends, supposedly have a turnover of trillions of dollars in the very short term, and is reckoned will save cost to the tune of something like 10% over orthodox means of supplying such parts. And there are many other examples of transformations produced by the internet that are not simply for the future, but are already being engaged in by contemporary corporations and, of course, by others working outside the economic sphere as such. So I think it would be difficult to deny this is a period of massive technological transformation. And the next transformation seems likely to be what Jeremy Rifkin calls the biotech century. That is the integration of information technology with biotechnology and with the impact of the genetic revolution more generally. Where does this lead us? Well, it does seem to me, Nancy might disagree, or I'm sure we could discuss it afterwards, that our relationship to science and technology is rather different from what it was in previous generations. Science and technology for a long time have had a big impact on our lives, but I feel that for a long while, because the pace of change was probably slower, because you didn't have the globalization of science and technology like you do today, science and technology didn't intrude directly on our lives as much and as profoundly and as consequentially as they do now. Once this happens, I think we're all in a kind of dialogue with them. You can't wait around for scientists to discover the quote truth unquote about the forms of innovation and technology which affect our lives, because they're already here. So if you consider any of the debates in contemporary society like GM foods or whatever it might be, these are not debates which can safely be left to the quote scientific experts unquote, because scientific experts are bound to disagree given the intrinsically contested nature of scientific development. a kind of dialogue with science and technology, therefore seems to me to be becoming part of contemporary politics, although it's hard for politicians to get used to this, hence the mistakes that are made when politicians make announcements about intrinsically uncertain states of scientific knowledge, as the Conservative government did with BSE, and then amazingly, as the Labour government also did with GM crops and GM foods. Anyhow, I think the great technology debate surely can only get more intense, because although it may be true that, you know, Gumpel might be right, I mean, he says this is not a technological society. His book tries to counter the idea that there are kind of endless technological advances, but it doesn't seem to be plausible in the case of developments in the biological sciences and developments in the informatic sciences. And it looks almost certain that these will have further and fundamental transformative force in the years to come, and social scientists had better get used to studying. One of the reasons why I think the centre has such an important role in the LSE is that it is one of the only places in the LSE where it is possible for social scientists to get some kind of grasp of the interaction between science, technology, and social life, including, of course, the famous ethical issues which these things lead to. The third great debate, is the great debate about everyday life, or if you want to put it in a more narrower context, the great debate about the family. Among the big trends happening in the world, nothing is more important, really, than the sorts of trends which are affecting our individual lives and affecting our emotional lives in our relationships with one another. These things are also geared to a number of different changes, but surely one of the most significant is the changing relationship between the sexes worldwide. The movement of women to become, if not equal to men, certainly to claim that equality. The worldwide movement of women into the labor force. These things are enormously consequential for the rest of our social and economic institutions. Behind them, I feel, lies not just economic change, but a kind of shift in the zeitgeist, as it were, that affects our the way in which we see ourselves, especially in Western societies, but becoming generalized elsewhere. Boldly put, I think one could see this as a retreat from custom, tradition, and habit. Custom and tradition seem to me to shape our lives less and less, which means that this brings you back to the future, because it means you have to actively structure your life, largely often on an individual basis, not only on a collective one. Not only if you want to have a sense of what your own future will be, but if you want to actually have a coherent personal identity at all. You can see this easily in the changing relationship between the sexes. You could say that until a generation ago, for many women, life had a certain fate for them, and this was ipso facto true of many men. If you're a woman, historically, your role was domestic. You might have worked in the fields and so forth, but it was your life to bring up and nurture children, often many of them. This is no longer the case. Now, this extraordinary phenomenon that EU countries of the lowest birth rates ever known in human history. The birth rate in Spain and Italy, which are supposedly Catholic countries, where they supposedly don't use contraceptives, remember, is only about 1.2, which is quite amazing. I don't know of any other historical examples like that. There are only a couple of countries in the EU which have anything close to a reproduction rate. Women, therefore, not stopping having children, but playing the decision to have a child is a quite different type of decision from what it was in the past, not just for women, but of course for men too. To be a woman now, it seems to me, is a much more open project, and that is an emancipatory thing, but it's also a very difficult one to handle. That's why with the rising freedoms of women, you also get this really interesting phenomenon of the emergence of eating disorders, which don't have a very long history. Anorexia and other eating disorders, you can trace them back to the late 19th century, but they begin to explode in Western countries from about the early 1960s onwards. That, I feel, is because diet increasingly becomes governed by lifestyle, and it becomes governed by what kind of person you claim to be in a world which looks at you both as a free agent, but also still looks at you as a woman, and therefore judges you in terms of certain norms of physical appearance. And some women can't cope with the stresses which this produces. We see similar stresses now affecting men. Anorexia now, about 10% of anorectics now are actually men rather than women. Anyhow, all this, the most probably rambles around too much, but much of this centers on a debate on the future of the family, really. And I feel the future of the family is the front line in the struggles around fundamentalism across the world. Fundamentalism, religious fundamentalism, seems to be driven by purely religious imperatives, but I feel a lot of it is driven actually by a sexual imperative and resistance to the kinds of changes which are predicated upon more emancipated role for women. Therefore, a lot of it centers around the traditional family, traditional norms of sexuality, and so forth. I have views on these things. I think the traditional family is incompatible with sexual equality. And therefore, I think if you want to create a society, as I would think we surely should, of sexual equality, you have to recognize the traditional family cannot survive this transformation. Doesn't mean that strong families can't be developed, doesn't mean that you can't have stable relationships, because surely you should aim for this, but the traditional family was largely founded on male power, usually enshrined in law in most cultures, including this one, and upon the general lack of power of children. Now children also have legally, internationally legally defined rights, which do count in courts of law. The fourth great debate I would define as the great political debate, and I feel that social scientists must define themselves in relation to this too. The great political debate, I could maybe illustrate, even though it's a bit late in this lecture, by telling a joke, always a risky thing to do. I told this joke at a lecture I gave in Germany about a week ago. Hardly anyone laughed, so... I laugh already, so... This is a Russian joke. There's a member of the new Russian bourgeoisie, right? All kind of chains and stuff, you know, and shiny suits and whatnot. Armani suits and things. Comes out of his house every day, gets into his big Range Rover. And every day, a policeman, traffic cop, comes up to him and fines him $50, saying, you know, your aerial's up too far, or your wheels are overinflated, or you polished your car too much, or whatever it might be. And then there's 2 weeks when the rich Russian is away. And when he comes back, the traffic cop comes rushing up to him and says, "Where you been? Where you been?" And the bourgeois Russian says, "Well, I've been on holiday. I've been away in the Bahamas on holiday." And the traffic cop says, "What? On holiday? On my money?" Well, he didn't really get it either. But anyway, I take this joke to be a parable, or one way of interpreting the joke, to be a parable of social justice and redistribution. That is, that you cannot have a society without norms of social justice and some means of redistribution, however corrupt that those forms of redistribution might be. Surely the great political problematic for us, the great political debate of our time, is how you can sustain norms of social justice and real policies of economic redistribution in a world which seems to be driving away from those things. How can one create on a local level, regional level, national level, global level, a society which is inclusive, which is just, where there is protection of the more vulnerable members of the society on a global as well as on other levels, but which still adapts to the extraordinary changes which seem to be actually elevating inequalities rather than decreasing them? Because according to most statistics, economic inequality in the world is on the increase, although there is some dispute about that, if you follow Amartya's formulation of a broader notion of what poverty means in terms of things like literacy and so on, things don't look so bad. By those criteria, the position of the poorer countries has improved rather than declined, but whatever you make of the trends, there is this gigantic division existing on the level of world society, and we see all around us divisions within our own societies. When you walk along the Strand, you have to step over the people sleeping in the doorways there. What to do about this world? Well, I wasn't going to mention the term third wave politics, but this debate is really a debate about how you find a different mode of development from the past. And for anyone who's interested in it, I would recommend the recent ruminations of Joe Stiglitz when he left the World Bank and he condemned some of the policies of the IMF. And what Stiglitz calls for is essentially, if you like, a third way, or at least a new approach to problems of social and economic development. Because he says, put again, very, very baldly, first of all, people believed in the post-war period that the state was the key to economic development. It's a particularly characteristic view on the left. After that, people started to think, well, the state hasn't been very successful, the market can do the job for us. That was, as it were, the period of IMF orthodoxy. That's the sort of thing that fetched the Seattle demonstrators out into the streets, the idea that you can simply create a world market and somehow all will be mysteriously resolved in this world marketplace. Well, Stiglitz says both views have proved ineffective. You need a new way of development economics. And I feel very sympathetic myself to the new way which he proposes, which is actually, it does have quite a lot of connections with what Amartya Sen says. He proposes a much more diversified approach to development, which stresses the connections between democratization, state building, civil society, the emancipation of women, and economic development. And I'm not, in a short period here, able to sort of represent these views in any detail, but I find his approach quite a commanding approach, really, to how we might effectively be able to reconcile some of the dilemmas which the world faces. Anyhow, we do need a different theory and practice of politics, I think. And I feel this applies on the level of national politics, and it applies on the level of global development too. Well, where does all this leave the social sciences? To me, you can't really be a social scientist, whether you're economist, anthropologist, sociologist, geographer, without situating yourself in some of these great problem areas, because these are, I'm sure there are others, but these are some of the big issues of our time. Can the social sciences deliver? What should they do to deliver? Well, I would say three things. First of all, the social sciences must surely deliver enlightenment. That is, there has to be a role for engaged theoretical reflection. Again, sort of picking out people in the audience of the kind that, say, Richard Sennett has produced about contemporary globalized capitalism. You need people who are prepared to chance their arm to produce innovative accounts, explanatory accounts of what is going on in the world. And you only look around to see, for example, the efforts by Manuel Castells and his gigantic three-volume work, the Network Society, to see an example of one attempt to try to figure out a conceptual framework for analyzing these changes. Second, I feel the role of social sciences is to bring some scholarly discipline into popular and public consciousness. I still feel, even though that notion is derogated by many people, I still feel there's a role for the public intellectual. I think the public intellectual is someone who works within the academy, who observes the norms of scientific rigor in the academy, but is still not only able, but is willing to communicate findings to a wider public and engage in a dialogue with that public. I do think there are very considerable problems, however, for university-based social science in this area, which reflect to some degree the problems of universities more generally. A generation ago, universities had more of a monopoly on the production of knowledge, especially in the political arena, than they do now. If you look back to the early 1970s, there were only three or four think tanks in London. Now there are about 30 think tanks operating in London, most of which have a kind of national orientation, not just London-based. Think tanks are quicker on their feet than universities are. They're more easy to, they find it easier to get their ideas represented in the media than universities do. Universities depend upon doing thoroughgoing research, which these new agencies are actually parasitic upon, but don't recognize their dependence on universities. And this, I think this can be a problem, so I think the way out of it is for at least some people in universities to directly engage with the public. Of course, to have a kind of dialogue as well between the little Spitfires that are the think tanks and the kind of Lancaster bombers that are the, well, not very good analogy, but that are the universities, rather aggressive analogy. But I think universities do need to think, especially in the social sciences above all, need to think how they should relate to the other agencies of knowledge, including management consultants and so on, that mostly deal in social scientific knowledge and sometimes are better at presenting it to a public than universities are. Finally, I would hope that the LSE would play a fundamental role in all these problem domains. The LSE has its distinguished history because although it's a fantastic intellectual institution, you know, with the best people really in the social sciences in the aggregate of any institution that certainly I've been in, it also has this history of addressing the problems of the world. It does have a history of connecting policy issues to intellectual issues in an effective way. And I would like to see it doing so in all these great debates which I've just identified. So in summary, to conclude with, if you ask, can the social sciences deliver an enlightened form of reflection on the world? Can the social sciences engage with the public? Can the LSE play a fundamental role in this? My answer would be yes, yes, and yes. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much for a fine lecture on the social problems that social science will be engaging in the next few years. There is a little time for discussion and questions. May I invite remarks from the audience, please? Yes, please. Thank you. Yes, wait for the microphone to come to you.
My question is meant to highlight something that is implicit, particularly in your summary. It concerns the four problem areas, specifically the ICT one, which is subsumed under that second rubric. Given that, given that one of the most profound effects, I believe you would concur, of ICT is going to be in the whole area of education, in the structure and function of the entire educational establishment, right through university up to the very highest level. Do you not think that the social sciences should play a very active role in facilitating the accommodation of the whole educational establishment to the consequences of these dramatic implications of ICT?
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for that question. Can I answer it with a little parable? Not a parable, but a real story, which is one of my favorites about the impact of information technology and the internet. which is the fate of the Encyclopaedia Britannica. Encyclopaedia Britannica for 200 years was the solidest form of knowledge you could have, and you know, you could have it on your bookshelves, and these rather optimistic salesmen would go around your house and try and sell you this bloody thing for some immense sum of money, and it was revised every 10 years. What a brilliant thing it was. Well, then in the 1990s, Microsoft offered issued a CD-ROM-based encyclopedia, as did another publisher, and the bottom completely dropped out of the market, the Encyclopaedia Britannica. They then tried to produce, and they stopped producing. They then tried to produce a CD-ROM, but reacted by the radical strategy of putting the whole thing on the internet. And they are, although it's still, as I understand, a subscription service, all 40 million words of it, it is likely to be available free to any user. Far from being revised every 10 years, it's revised every 2 hours or something like that. Here you have an example of what would, you know, would seem to be a really solid institution, sort of minor version of the Soviet Union, if you like, disappears into thin air almost overnight. So it is possible that the internet might have very radical implications for education. You consider the LSE. The LSE's been around less time than Encyclopaedia Britannica, been around 100 years. Will it still be around in 20 or 30 years' time? Well, certainly hope so, but I think you can be less sure of that than one would have done a few years ago. Where are the biggest growing universities in the world? Well, they are the University of Phoenix and the ITT learning system in India. And they are purely internet-based universities. And they have enormous growing student bodies. They see tutors, but they don't have a centralized campus to which they go. Now, maybe that, I mean, therefore, I think the transformative force in higher education is going to be pretty strong. LSE is directly involved in this UNEX.com global internet-based education system with Stanford, Carnegie Mellon, Chicago and Columbia, so we'll see what comes of that. It is likely to be transformative, I think. It's going to affect universities a lot. For example, in the UNEX.com, people sitting here might not like this, but they're going to guarantee that every essay will be marked within 24 hours. Well, most students here will not have had this experience in the LSE. Now, maybe people want to go to campuses even more, because even though everyone's got a computer, where is the most crowded place? Well, it's the library. It used to be when the library was on site. So maybe, you know, we're all here in this lecture. We're not sort of doing it all through information technology. So what some sociologists call the compulsion of proximity might become more important rather than less important. But you absolutely, I think, do not know. You know, LSE has this brand, and you might think, oh, well, you know, it's going to be able to exploit this brand. But some people say that branding is going to be more or less completely unimportant now, because people will just opt for the best services they can get, whatever field it is. You know, people used to be loyal to their banks. After your football team, it was the thing you were most loyal to, your bank. But that probably rested on the difficulty getting information about other kinds of options. I don't think people are going to be loyal to banks anymore. And people might just choose to get the best service, as long as it's guaranteed and protected, without any concern about the brand name of that service. So the whole of higher education is in an interesting phase of development, and as far as the LSE is concerned, we're trying to be involved and see where it leads us, and see if we can participate in it with, at the same time, maintaining all the traditional things that the LSE has to offer.
Okay, other questions? Richard Bradley, please. I didn't see any upstairs. If there were, could you raise your hands?
Well, I was interested to see that you chose to discuss the future in terms of problems and debates that we thought might emerge in the, at least in the short-term future, rather than in terms of theoretical developments or developments in the concepts and the tools of the social sciences. And perhaps it's because you think that those latter developments are, in a sense, subordinate to the first kind. Perhaps it's because you don't want to antagonize too many of your colleagues.
Do you mean research tools and so on?
Yeah, analytical tools or methodologies, but also, you know, in terms of the kinds of social theories that are on offer. But really, I would like to drag you into discussing some of the implications of the development of new problems on, I mean, certain kinds of theories out because they just have no hope in dealing with these kinds of problems, or certain kinds of tools in because they're precisely what we need to tackle them?
Yeah, well, I think it's a very fair question, actually, and Max Stoy never seems to think that I mean this, but I mean, I do believe in rigorous social science, and I think that the tools that social scientists have, which do include the possibility of at least in some areas, achieving much more precise knowledge, including knowledge of the causal mechanisms that move things, than are available to people who are not specialist social scientists. And I think, insofar as those are the tools you're talking about, they would still be crucial for us. And my view is it should be ecumenical about them. That is, I don't think there's any particular form of social science which should dominate over the others, and there should be a kind of endless dialogue between people who use certain research tools and people who are more prone to use others, as, you know, as the long-standing quantitative versus qualitative debate, you know, sort of implies. But it may be that you can use some kinds of well-established tools of social science in effective ways for understanding very general trends, I think, and I think that's quite interesting, because I don't know if anyone here, Richard, you would have seen probably Mitch Dunier's study of the homeless in New York, which is quite a lot of it is about the kind of conversations of the homeless, what it means to be homeless and so forth. It's a kind of ethnographic study, but certainly relevant, I think, to very big issues, because it's a kind of study of how people actually relate to and experience the big changes, some of which I've been alluding to here. So I'm in favor of a diversity of methodological tools in the social sciences, but I don't at the moment see anything that I would say is sort of something massive new breakthrough which will somehow, as a procedure of social science, help us to do what we couldn't do before. I don't know if you've got something in mind yourself.
Okay, we have a question in the front row upstairs, and then Sebastiano down here, and see where we are then.
I'm not sure whether this is so much a question as a comment, but I was actually struck by your telling analogy at the end of knowledge as a form of weapon. Okay, we have the little Spitfire and the Lancaster bomber universities. And one of the things which was not dealt with in your lectures, but I think is a very interesting aspect of the social sciences, is that in the hierarchy of sciences, they come very low. Now, why is that? That is clearly because the failure of the social sciences is to develop technologies of control. And the hierarchy of the sciences has more to do with technologies of control than it has to do with anything else. You can see the contemporary rise of biology precisely in terms of its actually now developing these remarkable technologies of control through genetics and so on and so forth. That's what they're promising. Okay? So I was wondering, okay, why you left out this surely extraordinarily important aspect of information technology, which is largely to do not so much with the dissemination of information as such, but with the dissemination of ideology. Yeah, and the nature of that whole technology as an ideological device, and indeed,
as a control mechanism.
Yes,
you mean.
And an arm of empire.
I understand that you seem to think there are no empires left. I think the rest of us are very likely to think that there is at least one massive empire left.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with the fact that you put your finger on something you didn't discuss very much directly, but I would tend to disagree with the way in which you put it, because I think the history of these technologies, including information technology, is often an attempt at control, but then a kind of elision and a disappearance of that, followed by further attempts to produce control systems. So that if you look at the history of the internet, where the internet come from, well, it was a defense mechanism. It was a Cold War invention of the US State Department, you know, which is trying to make sure that the Soviet Union couldn't penetrate the information systems of the Pentagon. That's where it came from. So it was very much bound up with control mechanisms in even a narrow sort of sense. But then it became taken over by universities, and then it became, in a certain sense, taken over by everybody. And then it led to a vast range of exchange of information across the world, which no one at the moment directly controls, even though governments are seeking ways to regulate it, and no doubt will. And of course there are all sorts of, like, you know, subtle and not so subtle connections between the accumulation of information, hierarchy, control systems, and freedom from those systems. For instance, every time you visit an internet site, it leaves a cookie with you. And that cookie can be used for numerous different purposes. Every time you go out in the street, you're liable to be under surveillance camera. There's this very good book that one of our authors at Polity wrote on the surveillance society. People don't realize normally how many cameras there are around and how often they're caught on those cameras. So there's a kind of dialectics of all that. But if you're saying that the movement is towards a society of control, I don't think that's true. I think it's much more of a sort of dialectical process of some kinds of groups trying to use information for certain purposes, the partial escape of that information, others using it subversively, because you have all sorts of subversive groups like the ones, say, countercultural groups who turned up in Seattle and so on themselves using the internet. You have religious fundamentalists using the internet. So very complicated business, certainly not a one-way extension of control mechanisms.
So, Sebastiana? And then I think there's a in the back, and then Northcote, and that may be maybe it.
In the picture that you describe, seems to me that these rapid changes that you mentioned are going to have impact on social science, social sciences as well. And in fact, this is what in my experience already happened in some of the social sciences. I'm referring in this case to economics and the need in economics to embody new values into the normative picture, so that the new changes that that the society is experiencing can be better understood and guided under the normative point of view. Then my question is, in some cases, the new values that need to be incorporated into the social sciences lead to some sort of clash, let's use this word, clash with the major results that the body of science has already established. The case of freedom, for example, in economics, which clashes with some tenets of the rationality, of economic rationality, is one of the examples. So I was wondering whether, in your opinion, this might create some problem with the possibility for social sciences to continue serving as a sort of guide in the solution of problems and in normative indication of what should be done.
But do you mean around the issue of rationality, or around the edges of rationality in some sense, do you mean?
I do.
Mean a clash of values? And
I'm referring in this case to a specific issue. Introducing certain views of freedom within the economic normative framework leads to the failure of the typical rationality assumption of economics described by the theory of revealed preferences. And in this case, so you have a situation in which social sciences tries to embody new information, new values in the evaluation of society, but then loses its generality in a sense, which leads to the question whether this is a problem for social sciences in the future in providing answers to the new problems of society.
Yeah, I mean, if you stick to the issue of rationality in economics, I mean, I'm not an economist, but as a non-economist, it certainly seems to me that you need economic models that operate with soft rationality rather than hard rationality. I mean, you know, models of hard rationality, as it were, like in rational expectations theory, operating within a kind of closed temporal universe, they can give you quite interesting findings and interesting sort of food for thought. But I think if you're going to analyze real things, like, say, the stock market, I personally, I don't think that those models are too convincing, although, as I repeat, I'm not an economist, but insofar as I read economics and so forth, I would incline to a more of a bounded rationality view. And I think in lots of circumstances people are more rational than many people assume they are. I think this is true in risk situations, for example. On the other hand, If you build a whole theoretical system around, as it were, pure rational models, I don't know, I think their limits are pretty profound when it comes to analyzing real processes of history, or if you really want to ask what happens on stock markets, or you want to ask why there was a Asian crisis, like, you probably need somewhat different models, and they have to explore phenomena like panic and crowd behavior and herd behavior, the sorts of things that Keynes described as part of stock markets a generation ago.
Tony, could I get you just to expand a tiny bit more on that? Because I took it that the suggestion, if you followed along that line, the underlying question was a question about these new problems forcing new methods, new kinds of theories into the social sciences. This being example of the soft rationality being a case, and that they're developing conflicts within the social sciences themselves because the techniques necessary to solve the problems that you're discussing, which rather interdisciplinary problems, immediate problems, clash with the established methods that one's used to using and create a great deal of normative conflict, real conflict of norms. And your suggestion in this case was to just develop some new methods. But I think the basic question was, is this going to make for a big crisis in the social sciences when we're all fighting with each other about what counts as good social science?
Sorry, I didn't understand.
Okay.
That was the... If that's so, I mean, I thought it was mainly about rationality that you were speaking.
That was an example, I think.
I mean, obviously, you could have clashes about rationalities, maybe you're implying, between different social scientists, because sociologists tend to operate different models of rationality from economists, at least in their more theoretical thinking, or at least many of them do. But whether this would lead to clashes between the social sciences, they try and collaborate to look at these issues. Obviously, this can't easily happen, but I don't think it, insofar as it does happen, it's necessarily just clash between the social sciences. You've got so many clashes within the social sciences, surely, because most social sciences, like philosophy, are themselves internally riven with disagreement. So I don't see that as particularly different from the past, I must say. And I don't really think that will be a bigger problem than it's been in the past. At least I don't see why it should be.
Let's see if we've got time.
You were going to let me off the hook.
Yeah, we're going to stop soon for a drink. It's just I promised the man.
Maybe the last question.
Yeah, I promised the man by the door who was early on, right?
Excuse me. You talked about West York's low growth rate, birth rate.
Can you take the microphone away from your mouth?
You talked about.
Slightly.
Is that all right? Can you hear me? Hello. Can you hear me now? You talked about Western Europe's low birth rate. Would you like to comment on Russia's negative birth rate?
Yes, Tony's talked about Western Europe's low birth rate, but would you like to comment on Russia's negative birth rate? Does it fit into your scheme somewhere?
I don't know what you mean by negative birth rate. I mean the birth rate in Russia has dropped. You have a negative reproduction rate, but I mean that's true in the European countries too. Still not sure what I'm required to comment on, really.
Wondered whether
you interpret for me.
I can't interpret where it fits into the general scheme of the social problems. Perhaps it was just an observation, and it would be a
I said Russia has a higher death rate than birth rate.
Oh, higher death rate, I see. Yeah, I see what you mean. Especially among Russian men, you mean. Where you get this average age of 57 or whatever his life expectancy is. Well, I don't know what I can comment about that, because that, you know, it's fairly well known what that reflects, I think. It reflects certain things about styles of life, especially various kinds of patterns of drinking and so forth. It reflects high levels of unemployment. Well, it reflects more seriously high levels of unemployment that have come suddenly in Russia, and it represents ecological issues too, that because of the poor ecological record of some of the Soviet pass. So what one should do about it is I think largely geared to social reforms. I think the key question is, can you restart the Russian economy and can you produce a decent civil society in that country? We don't really know the answer to that for sure. But I think that's a bit different from what I was talking about. So certainly bound up with these changes, obviously. Certainly in some part an expression of them, especially obviously the end of the Cold War and all that. Well, can I thank you again for inviting me, and can I wish the Centre every good fortune?
Moreover, I think I'm supposed to make the obvious remark that I can invite you all to lower your life expectancy a bit by joining us for a drink on the fifth floor. And let's thank Tony very much for coming and giving this fine lecture.